It's an honor for me to introduce President Eyring as our devotional speaker today. I've been privileged to work closely with him for the past 5 years since his arrival in Rexburg as the 10th president of Ricks College. He's been a great influence upon my life personally, and I've learned much from his example and association. Many of you in this audience could say the same thing. To others assembled here today, this may be your first introduction to President Eyring. I'd like, therefore, to take the liberty of presenting some of his background to you so that you may know him better. He was born in Princeton, New Jersey, while his father was teaching at Princeton University. Later, he obtained degrees in higher education from the University of Utah and from Harvard University, where he received his MBA and his DBA from the School of Business Administration, the graduate school. His experiences in higher education include that of a visiting faculty fellow at MIT. Later, he was an associate professor at Stanford University in the Graduate School of Business. And since 1971, he has been with us here at Ricks College, serving as our president. His business experiences include many rich and varied experiences. He's been on the board of directors of several corporations and is presently serving with the McCulloch Corporation of Los Angeles on their board of directors. He is used frequently by many of the large corporations throughout the country as a consultant. He helps them solve some of the problems peculiar to their corporations. Now, these are impressive credentials, but to me, there are some that are even more impressive. As I know President Eyring, he's a man of God. He's very spiritual and humble. He has always strived to serve his Heavenly Father in the way that he feels is best and that he's expected to serve. He has been a bishop at the Stanford Board in California, and he is presently serving as a high councilman in the Rexburg, Idaho East Stake here in Rexburg. In addition to that, he sets the spiritual tone for this campus in many ways. And one that many of you are familiar with is his role as a religion teacher every Tuesday and Thursday. One of his greatest accomplishments, and I know he would agree with me on this, is his marriage to the former Kathleen Johnson, who is seated next to him today on the stand. They have 4 lovely sons, and I'm really impressed with the way he is able to work with his sons. The demands on his time are great, and he doesn't have a lot of spare time, but he gives them the optimum in quality. When he's with them, they have a rich experience, and I can attest to that. He has a love for the students of Ricks College. He has your interests at heart, and he's a great speaker, in constant demand as a speaker. He always delivers a message of great worth to us. And so I'm looking forward to his remarks today, as I know you are, and I would implore you to give careful attention that you may apply the message that he has for us today. It's a pleasure to present President Henry B. Eyring.
Thank you. I'm grateful for that introduction. Pray that the Spirit of the Lord might help us all, that we can be edified together. Mac's introduction made me remember an incident this morning that has happened to me all over the church, but never at Ricks College before. A student stopped me in the hallway and said, "Kelly, I understand your father's speaking at the devotional today." And she seemed very excited, as I would be too. I'd rather hear him than me. And I said that no, it was me, and she tried to look happy. But I thought I would announce that I understand that they're negotiating with my father, that he may be a speaker later, and so I will think of this today as my introduction to him, and you'll enjoy him if he does come. But I just wanted to tell you, I am not my father. Although when I look in the mirror, there are times I wonder who that old fellow is looking back at me. I'm grateful for the chance to visit with you, and I thought what I'd do today is just visit a little. And again, I think I'd use Brother Shirley's introduction to make some comments about myself. Some of you don't know me very well. You know me a little bit more by that story, but you always probably shut off when you hear that kind of a description a little bit. I know I tend to. You'll notice that my life began in Princeton, New Jersey, in the mission field, where my father was a professor. He then left there and became a professor at the University of Utah, and I then went there to do my college work. And then you heard the descriptions of where I went to school, and you may have noticed that I have never left school. I was born in a school kind of family, in a little college town, smaller than Rexburg, where the only industry was Princeton University. And then I've either been in schools or been working at them all my life. So I've not been in the real world yet. So I thought, rather than try to tell you about the real world, I'd better be careful and stick to the things that I know something about. And I thought what I'd like to try to do in just a casual way today, and I mean by casual, not that I haven't prepared carefully, but rather that I'll try not to be too stuffy, to talk with you the way that college students at many colleges and universities are talked to by either the president of the college or sometimes by the dean of the academic side of the institution. And since you've not perhaps had that kind of a lecture ever given to you, let me describe how it usually goes, and then I'm going to do it differently. Generally, they assemble, usually the freshman class, they'll get you all together when they're about to make you into college students. And some very famous fella will stand up, and he'll really ram it to you about how you are no longer high school students. And he says it in kind of a way to make it sound how bad that is. And that you are now, and they usually use the phrase, joining the community of scholars. And they say it kind of like that to scare you. That means the tests are hard. And, you know, what are you really doing here in college? And then they go on and talk to you about that particular college's vision of what the educational purpose is of their college. They're trying to give you that feeling of, boy, when we get done with you, you are going to be different and better. And you better be. And they try to give you that kind of a feeling. And generally, they'll describe what they're trying to do is to, and I love this particular description. It's quite frequent at some of the more distinguished universities and colleges. They'll say, we're going to develop your critical capacities. And one of the things they love to say is that when we get done with you, we don't care what your parents taught you, we'll have taught you to question it, and to question it with great vigor and with great skill. And that will be the great benefit that we're going to give you if you'll take advantage of this great college or university. That's often the way it's described. You know, I thought I've been here now, I'm doing my sixth year. I cannot seem to graduate at Ricks College. I just stay. And I, in all those 6 years, have not given such a talk where I told you what I thought was the kind of intellectual education we're trying to give you. And I thought I'd do it today. Now, I appreciate just using the word intellectual. Some of you are already drowsing off, and I got to be careful, and so I promise you it'll be painless and yet intellectual as we go along. But I just thought I owed that to you once, and I'll tell you why I've not done it. I have such a high regard for this institution where you're now studying, that I think it's only after about 6 years I have the temerity to try to suggest what I think the Lord is trying to do here with your education. And I mean that sincerely. I think that this institution is touched by the hand of the Master. That the people who are here, that the educational process that's here are of concern to Him, that He's been guiding it a long time, and therefore that rather than coming and saying, I'm going to shape it, I've spent some years trying to understand it, and let me see if I can't describe to you what I think is the intellectual problem at Ricks College. And I'd sort of describe it this way. Most of us, and I include myself with you, wouldn't feel very comfortable with charge to them that come to Ricks College and we're going to turn you into people who are great critics that we're going to develop your critical ability so that you can ask lots of questions and question things and delve deeply and find a lot of things not to be true and discover a few things that are true. At the same time, you know, I'm concerned that you have this difficulty. And I think we all share it to some extent. Most of us are probably frightened by how poor our mental equipment seems to be. Most of you, I notice, do not flock to the hardest calculus class you can find at Ricks College. That, as I've checked with the mathematics department, I use that as an example. That's not the hardest thing in the world, but it's not the easiest, I promise you. And I wonder if, at least to some degree, that may be. Because if I know you well, and I think I'm getting to know you fairly well, 6 years of getting acquainted with a lot of you and your older brothers and sisters and friends, I think I'm getting to know you fairly well. And most of you, I think, if you were asked to describe your brain, would be very modest. And you would say, well, it's this thing I've been trying to get in gear for a long, long time. Occasionally it has flashes. But it's got these long periods of seeming to be very quiet in there. And I have a lot of trouble getting it around certain kind of ideas. And I've really got a lot of concerns about how bright I am. Could I start by not talking to you about the philosophy of Ricks College, but a fact? Your mind, and I'm speaking out to everyone in this room, including some people who've probably had learning difficulties, quotes on learning difficulties over their lifetimes, where people have told them that they are not as quick as others. Your mind is a marvelous instrument, every one of you. Let me give you an illustration. Since I've begun talking, I've been watching you carefully, and I notice you're not all just riveted on me. Do you know why that is? Because I'm not saying enough, rapidly enough, and exciting enough to take your whole attention. In fact, you've been watching that guy or girl, depending on what your gender is, out of the corner of the eye. You've checked them out 3 or 4 times in the last few minutes. Or if not the one who's sitting there, the one you wish were sitting there. And I'll tell you a fascinating thing about your mind. You've imagined that one you wish was sitting there as clearly or more clearly as the one who is there. Every detail. Have you noticed that? Now, just since I've said those words, your mind has flashed. It's gone. Some of you have been 1,000 miles and back in just the time that I've been speaking just that word. And some of you haven't come back. You see, you're still there. And do you see those feelings? Do you see what's happening? And that's just part of what you're doing. You're hearing my voice. You're seeing some things. You're noticing people next to you. Your mind is a magnificent instrument. And what's really, I think, impressive to some of you, and I'm speaking now to some, may I speak to the ones who not only feel they are poor students, but those who have proved it. There are some in the room, no doubt, who say, well, he may be kidding some people, but he's not kidding me, because I sit in classes and I never pay attention. Now, I'd say this about you. I don't care how much you think you are not bright. Think of you as you sit in the class not paying attention. Is your mind a blank? On the contrary, it's all over the lot. Now, it may have nothing to do with what the poor teacher is laboring to do, but those of you who think of yourselves as the weakest intellectually have incredible powers of thought. Do you understand that? Have I made that believable to you? Just as I've been sitting talking to you, you've demonstrated it. Your mind can just go everywhere and do all sorts of things. Now, I'd like to suggest, and this is almost my little message to you, this picture, your problem, my problem, is not the poverty of my intellectual equipment. It's not my poor pea brain. And if I could just get it in somewhere where I could deal with it, it's so small. That's not your problem. Your problem is having way more intellectual capacity than you have any ability to harness. I mean that sincerely. I'm not just giving a you can do anything kind of talk. I'm giving you my honest opinion. And that, in fact, even people who are thought of as deranged or have great difficulty intellectually in all sorts of ways in performing certain kinds of feats almost always are miraculous in their abilities in other areas. The mind is an instrument far beyond your present ability to control and can handle way more than you're asking of it. And that's not just being kind to you, that's stating a fact. Now let me suggest then to you an analogy, if I can. The price of calculators is coming down so rapidly that now it's getting to where many of you even buy them, or at least have them. And isn't that interesting? Because here you have this little box, and it, you know, this one I was given for Christmas, and it's my very favorite toy right now. I don't know, it's got little batteries in it, and it lights up here. Have I owned one before? Yes, I've owned one before. Did I own one before that? Oh, yes. I buy them quite regularly. I always have this feeling if I can buy one just a little zippier, something marvelous is going to happen and my life will change. Have you had that same feeling? Somehow if I can just wear it, and then you wear it for a while and nothing happens, and then you say, I must need a smaller one, or one with more memory, or one with something else fancy in it, and so you get something. This one is very nice. And yet, you know, I've noticed the interesting thing is that, it's got power, tremendous power. And I use it very, very infrequently. And yet I'm packing it around with me. Now you might say, well, Brother Iring, your problem is you don't have a good enough calculator. My answer is I've got a calculator so much better that I know how to use, you can't believe it. If any of you are tempted to try to sell me one, please don't, because I bought lots of good ones. And I notice that no matter how good a one I have, I use it about the same amount. Now, do you know what the difficulty is? And this is the analogy I want to suggest to you. I think this little calculator is like your brain, that it, when I have it in my hand, is far more power than I can use. Now, let me analyze why I'm not using it well. And by doing that, suggest to you how you might use your brain. Okay? Now, there's just a couple of small problems about why I don't use my calculator much. First of all, is in almost every situation I'm in, I don't understand the problem, so I've got nothing to calculate. That is, I'm in a room and there's somebody working on something, but you know, you can't use the calculator until you know what the problem is. And you could give me lots more calculating capacity, and I'm never going to use it until I learn a little bit more about deciding what's the problem I want to understand. Now, let me tell you the second thing I don't do. Occasionally, I even understand the problem, okay? But then I say to myself, okay, I understand that problem. Now, let's see. I like to add some numbers, you know, particularly when your calculator is new, you so want to use it. You bring it out a good deal, and you always turn the light on, and you look at it, and you play with the numbers to make sure you're ready. You say, okay, now I want to put a number in it. You know, one of the difficulties is almost none of the problems I work with have I ever measured anything enough to have any numbers. So I don't have any numbers to put into the thing. And then suppose it is a problem that I have a few numbers about. I don't know whether to add them or subtract them or multiply them. And so I've got not much use for a calculator. Now, most of you have had a little experience with calculators, and you'll know what I've described is accurate. The fact is, this is for those of you who may someday go into the calculator business, I'm not really trying to knock calculators. They're wonderful. They're friendly and they light up and they occasionally are useful to you. But there's a great difficulty that if you don't know what problem you want to work on, if you don't have some facts, some numbers, and if you don't know how to operate on those numbers, a calculator is absolutely useless. Now, I'd just suggest to you, if I could, that what Rick's College and what the gospel of Jesus Christ both would do for you in terms of using your so far underutilized brain capacity is first, give you a capacity to recognize the real problems. Secondly, to give you an ability to get the facts that matter to those real problems. And the third thing is to give you an understanding of how to operate on those facts to find out what you should do. Okay? Let me just, if I can, talk about those three things. Now, I'm going to just, if I can, stick my neck way, way out and tell you what, if I could just convince you, if the Holy Ghost will just help us now in the next few minutes, I will have done something that I consider of great worth to you and to me. Let me tell you what I know about finding problems. Can I do that? Have you ever had the experience of sitting in a class at Ricks College and wondering why the teacher was so excited? He seems so excited, he wants you to know these plants. And you look at him and you think, that is the weirdest man I have seen in a long time. Because he somehow thinks, if I can identify those plants, that's good. Now, I'd like to play his game, but it looks a little odd to me. And I'm really just not clear at all what his problem is. But I know it's not mine. Have you had that experience? And over again, my guess is one of the reasons you fail to get excited about education is also one of the reasons you fail sometimes to get excited about the gospel of Jesus Christ. You haven't trained yourself to say, wait a minute, I'm not just picking up facts and information. I'm trying to ask myself an answer, ask this question and answer it for myself. What's the problem that really matters here? Now, let me give you kind of an example, if I can. It'd be just fun. Most of you in the room now have had some religion classes at Ricks College. It would be just a lot of fun to say, okay, what is the problem of a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints? What's the central problem in the study of religion at Ricks College as we teach it to you, or as indeed as it should be taught in the gospel of Jesus Christ? It'd be fun to hear all the answers. You could cook up a bunch of them. But let me kind of suggest to you, if I can, this one notion. My guess is the central problem, if I could help my little boys focus on one problem, it would be this one. Can I, or how can I, get a vision of myself and of God and how we are related? Can I get a vision of myself and God and how we are related? Now you say, do you mean you think just a vision of it, a picture of it is what? And I answer that, yes. Because what I'd say is this, if I ever could help my little boys or you, my brothers and sisters, get a true vision of yourself and of Heavenly Father and how you're related to each other, just that, then I've given you the little structure for all the religious problem solving you're ever going to need to do. I really believe that. I really do. Let me tell you how I think that's true. You've heard the advice given to you that when you're tempted, try humming the tune, I am a child of God, and see if that doesn't help you resist temptation. Why does it? Is it just because it's a cute tune and sentimental words? No, it's not. May I tell you what that really is? That's a way of getting you to vision, envision who you are. A little differently than your friends do, a little differently than you do most of the time. I am a child of God. Why does that matter? Because a child is like its father. Well, then that's not very helpful unless you have some vision of, well, what's the father like? All loving, kindly, a God of truth, a God of truth. Do you know that when the brother of Jared was asking for instructions about how to get light into a ship, he asked the Lord to touch the stones that there might be light. And he saw the finger of the Lord. He was stunned, just stunned. And he said, I didn't know that you had a body. He said, because of your faith, I had to let you see my finger. And then he questioned him. And he says, now do you believe the things that I tell you? He was going to show him not just his person, but everything. He was going to show him everything. And the key to unlocking that was the answer that the brother of Jared gave to the question, do you believe what I'm going to tell you? Do you know what the brother of Jared said? He said, yes, I believe. Thou art
a God of truth, and thou canst not lie. Thou art a God of truth, and thou canst not lie. Now, do you understand a little bit, at least to me, what I would, if I could possibly do, say to you that at least for me, the religious problem is for me to understand who I am, a child of God, and who God is, a God of truth, and what our relationship is. Do you know one of the first things I'll find out about that relationship? He'll say, "Golly, Hal, let's not talk about you and me. I want to talk about all your brothers and sisters. In fact, my relationship to you is mostly about how you and I can help them. Let's go and see what we can do for them." And then immediately, by knowing who I am, his child, and knowing who he is, a God of truth, then I find myself suddenly involved in a lot of other people. He says, "Let's go and let's help them." Now, what I'm saying to you is this kind of a thing. I'm not pretending that I've given you the answer to every quiz you'll ever take in religion, nor the way you'll read every scripture, nor the way you'll solve every spiritual problem. But what I'm saying is, at least to me, the central problem that I address every time I pick up the scriptures, the central problem for me is to say, who am I? Who am I? And who is God? And when I have that vision, let me tell you what that unlocks for me, if I can. I love that phrase, "Thou art a God of truth, and thou canst not lie." He could have said, "And I know you won't, or I'll bet you won't." He said, "Thou canst not lie." Is that because God has lost his free agency? I think not. I think it's because to be a God of truth, he cannot lie. God knows who he is. He's a God of truth, and therefore he cannot lie. If I can just come to understand who I really am, that's going to unlock in me the power to do what's right. That's why that little song, "I Am a Child of God," can buck you up. It isn't just a neat little thing that reminds you of primary. It says, "I am a child of God." Well, what would a child of God who knew he was a child of God, what would he do? Do you understand what it could do for you and me and my little boys? If every time they're ever presented with choices, the influences of Satan and of the master, a feeling comes over them, "I am a child of God. God is a God of truth. He can't lie. I'm his child. I can't do the wrong thing. I have to do the right thing. That's who I am." Now, I'm not pretending that if they had that vision and that faith that they wouldn't make some mistakes, but I'll make this challenge to you. I'll say, examine your own life for those times you've acted badly. And Satan has at least either made you not think of that central question or has given you a lying answer that says you're less than a child of God and that God is not a God of truth, or perhaps he's not there or he's far away. But that if you just knew that, who you were and who he is and how he feels about you, then not only do you see, does it help you focus your thinking as you try to understand the gospel of Jesus Christ, but also it's going to change your behavior. It's going to give you the power to control yourself. Now, my view, again, is not that I'm trying to impose on you my definition of the problem. In fact, I invite you to leave today and say, "Gosh, I don't think Brother Eyring's got that defined very well at all. In fact, to the faculty, bless their hearts, they're very creative. At least half of them have already thought I'm wrong, and I think that's terrific." Because they would say, "No, I'd pick it up another way, Brother Eyring. I'd say the central problem in trying to understand the gospel of Jesus Christ is this." My answer to them is, for you, you're right. I don't know the answer for you. But my, would you follow their example? What they are is not people who can tell you the question, the problem, to be solved any better than I can. But I'm one that can invite you to look at the gospel that way. Could I invite you, every time anybody ever gives you a lecture, anybody ever tells you something in a class, to use that notion and say, "Now, wait a minute, what's the problem that makes this important?" Now, frequently, and that moves to the second notion, they seem to be, a faculty member, seems to be trying to give you facts. Da-da-da-da, this fact, this fact, this fact, this fact. And you say, "Wait a minute, I don't want those facts, because I don't yet understand what's the problem they would help me deal with." Sometimes your professors will help you with that. Sometimes they'll say, no, I first have to give you the facts before you can even understand what the problem is. Have faith, but be a little bit insistent with yourself that you're always saying, wait a minute, yes, I'll work on the facts. I'll have faith that they will make a difference. But my way of thinking is always to try to understand what's the problem they would help me solve. Okay? Now, finally, this last notion that I would suggest to you is that it isn't just enough to get facts, and it isn't just enough to get problems. You need to have some understanding of how do you put together some of the facts to help you solve problems. Can I give an illustration if I can? Hopefully, we've got you reading the scriptures, and you read them regularly. To me, simply to read the scriptures, and even if you remember them fairly well, is the gathering of facts. Now, you see, if you, in fact, want to solve some problems, you'd say, well, wait a minute, facts, you need to know how to use them to work on problems. Could I just suggest this one little notion to you? Let me make a note taker out of you this way. And the bookstore may get a rush on 3x5 cards if I'm successful here, and I apologize if they run out. But you know, a nice way to think of yourself is as a fact gatherer that doesn't like the order that other people give you the facts in. I love 3x5 cards. You know, one of the things I do is when I find scriptures that I love, I put them on cards. Sometimes big scriptures, I notice, take bigger than 3x5. I'll warn you, don't just get 3x5 if you're going to do scriptures and if you've got big type on your typewriter. You need larger. But I love to get cards, and then I run them around. And I say, well, let's put them together this way. Do you know what I've learned? One little exercise I used to do when I was a student back in the East years ago is every night I would read two different places in the scriptures, and I would force myself to compose a talk that embodied both those scriptures, putting two apparently disparate ideas together. Do you know what I found? You can do it every time. And the more apparently disparate the scriptures are, the more exciting the idea that comes out from them. Now, I just suggest to you, you see, that one of the things you need to learn to do is when people are running facts at you, try yourself seeing how they combine in new ways, how you can use them in new ways to solve problems. Now, I appreciate that what I've said to you today, and I'm almost done, and I see you're looking very sober because you're saying, he's talking like a teacher. And I thought he was going to come and buck up my spirits, and instead he's lecturing to me about how to be a student. I think what I'm trying to teach you is both how to be a student of worldly things and a student of heavenly things. What I'm trying to suggest to you, for instance, is listen to me right now. Let's play it in this game. You should say, what is Brother Iring working on here? What is the problem that he seems to be addressing? Remember, the problem is that we've got tremendous amounts of brain capacity way beyond what we're harnessing. And Brother Iring is trying to give you a feeling that says, look, instead of sitting around and wringing your hands and saying, what a dummy I am, I just hope I can get out of this place and learn a little and get some decent grades and all my poor inabilities and I better stay out of certain classes. To take the other view and to say, have you ever noticed how little you ever use your brain? How little you listen? Most of you during this probably you're very happy, haven't listened to me very much. You've sampled me now and then to see where I'm going. But you tend, you know, to have your mind on many things. That's the problem. Or turn it around, the opportunity. Do you know, rather than worrying about how dumb you are, think if you're focusing your mind as tiny a proportion of the time as you now are, a slight improvement could be 100% gain. You know, all you'd have to do is think 5 minutes a day, and that's 100% better if you've only been thinking 5 minutes a day. Do you understand? And so the worse you are, the greater your opportunity. You see, the poor bright guys are in real trouble because they're using their brains maybe 10% of the time. It's very hard for them. If they would improve, you know, they have to work harder at it. That's the problem or the opportunity I'm trying to describe to you. Do you follow what I'm doing? Now, what I'm simply doing is I'm saying, okay, one of the things you want to do, if that's the problem, is you need to get information. You can't work on problems without information. Do you know one of the reasons your minds are freewheeling all the time? They've got nothing to grind on. You haven't put enough facts in there. As an example, I could shake my finger and say, what's the matter with you? Why don't you think about the gospel?
Well, I might ask you, everyone in the room stand up, who can remember the contents of five scriptures. You know, and five people or six or ten, or I don't know how many stand up. And then it's not fair for me to get after the rest of you. You've got no data in there to work on. How can you sit and think about the gospel? You haven't stowed anything in there. Or at least maybe I could ask you to go home and take out all your 3x5 cards that have scriptures. And let's start going. And you know, you wouldn't have any in many cases. So what I'm suggesting to you then is this second notion of simply saying it's not enough to say that I think I know what problems are in the area that I'm trying to understand, but I've gotten some facts. And then finally, you need some experience, and it comes from experience in putting the facts together to try to solve problems. Now, let me, if I can, just sort of end this way to you. This has seemed perhaps to you a strange exercise. Let me tell you how I think it's not a strange exercise. We had, from this pulpit once, a president of a university give a talk. It was gorgeous. It was beautifully done. And it's the title of it was Excellence. And he got after you, as he gets after students everywhere he goes, to be excellent intellectually. And I remember afterwards I had several people come to me and say, Brother Eyring, you're awful. Or no, they said nicer than that. Brother Eyring, you could do better, is the way they'd say it. Because, gee, here's this fellow coming from outside, and he's the one who urges us to academic excellence. Yet, you're seeming to emphasize so much the spiritual. Doesn't that somehow take away from the intellectual climate of the campus? Could I tell you how I think that's not true? I would think if you view spiritual study and growth as simply having good feelings or just doing good, you miss the mark. The scriptures are clear in saying, who is going to know the mysteries of God? And the scriptures make it clear that it will come to those who give heed and diligence, and suggest that it will depend on your ability to use your mind to understand the mysteries of God. Now, I believe what that means is this. If you don't make an effort now, and I beg of you to do it, to say, I'm not going to define myself as an intellectual, I'm not asking that of you, but to say, I'm the kind of a person who in any situation is always trying to say to myself, how would I define this problem? I'd say that to those of you in auto mechanics. If you think you're in auto mechanics at Ricks College because you're not good with your brain, then you don't know very much about fixing cars. Because a lot of people can make a wrench go. A lot of people can do things with their hands, but you don't solve problems with cars with your hands. You solve them with your brain. I built a cabinet last Saturday for my family, a little cabinet. Years ago, I tried to build a cabinet like that and I failed. Is it because I'm now better with my hands? No. I envisioned that cabinet. I knew every nook and cranny, every board. Everything that I was going to do, I knew, and then I could do it. It was my mind that got better, not my hands. This school, although we talk a great deal about the gospel of Jesus Christ, although we teach courses where you may use your hands primarily, this is a college of the mind, because it is your mind honed and used which will make a god of you or a servant of Lucifer. The scriptures say, whosoever that looketh after a woman to lust after her hath committed adultery already in his heart. The mind. And the scriptures say that he who can imagine in Alma what it will be like to raise up in incorruption after going down to the grave in corruption, he it is who is born again. Now I bear you my testimony. I can visualize on my good days the day I will rise up again in glory. My mother died a number of years ago of cancer, and she's buried in a graveyard under Mount Olympus in Salt Lake City.
My father purchased in that burial lot places for all of us. I'm not sure where Kathy's going to put me. She'll outlive me. And I don't know if she'll put me there, but I'll tell her now that I have envisioned the day. On the morning of the first resurrection, I see myself rising up with my mother and my father. I'm not sure those mountains will still be there. There's something about the mountains being changed. But I see that. And you say, well, that's arrogant. You don't look to me like the kind of guy that's going to rise up in glory. My answer to you is, but I've envisioned something else. This day, in that same place in Alma, it says that those who are going to be born again need to have the capacity to feel the redemption working in their life. I bear you my testimony. I know who I am. I'm not perfect. But I'm a guy who's been baptized into the true church of Jesus Christ by someone that had the authority to do it. Christ really died for my sins. And I felt today, I'll even tell you the minute that it occurred, a feeling of assurance that says today I had some sins washed away, taken away by the power of the atonement. I'm being born again. I'm not perfect, but I changed today. I know that. I know that's who I am. And I can envision the day when I can rise up again in the morning of the first resurrection. You see, that's an exercise of the mind. That's that same mind that runs off where I don't want it to run. But occasionally I've developed the capacity to make it focus on a problem, to stay there for just a moment. I bear you my testimony that part of that was developed in physics classes years ago. I don't remember my physics very well. But boy, I learned to think hard and think carefully. I learned how to define a problem. I learned how to gather facts. I learned how to operate on those facts to solve problems. I've learned it in other places in my life. I use all of them in that exercise of saying today, can I feel the atonement work in my life? Yes. Where? How can I make it work? I know something about the atonement. I have some facts. I've experimented with those facts. I know ways to feel sins being washed away by the power of the Master's atonement. I've felt that. I know that feeling. So now I just end this way. You'd say, well, Brother Eyring, doesn't the goal of perfection frighten you? You know, it talks about being without spot. Well, I guess I have spots. I think I'm not perfect. But I feel the process going on in my life. I can envision the day when I can rise up spotless and be with God. And the scriptures assure me that with that power of my mind, I'll both transform my life by the power of the atonement here, and someday I will rise with Him. Now I pray with my whole heart that you would begin to focus your minds, that you might use them. Work on many problems. Sharpen your mind. But above all, would you work on the central problem of finding for you those questions which, if you answer well, will lead you back again to your Father in heaven. I bear you my testimony. I've not seen His face, but I know He lives as surely as I know anything. And that my mind, enlightened and broadened by the Holy Ghost, which flows in when we focus our mind on spiritual things, has told me that He lives. I know it for a surety. I know that Spencer W. Kimball is a prophet of God. I know that. I know that the Master speaks to him. I know that the young men in this room who hold the priesthood are ministers of the Lord Jesus Christ on the Lord's errand. I know that the young women in this room who serve as Relief Society visiting teachers are on the Lord's errand, that it's real. That's who you are. I pray that you might envision that, that the Lord might expand your mind, that you might see that and know that it's true and know that He is, and that that might change your life, and that we can all envision ourselves. Can you envision this whole bunch rising up together? We all won't be in that same place. I can. I can envision myself someday seeing you. Oh, I pray it'll happen. Would you run up to me and say, hey, I remember that strange day you talked to us about those oddball things. And some of it stuck with me. And I got it other places anyway, better than you could do it. But I'm here.
And you asked me to come up and say hello. You know, as long as I've been at Ricks College, I've always told people going to the mission field, write me, I'll write back. I'm now making another invitation. Please, when we rise in the morning of the fresh resurrection, say hi, would you? We'll all go up and say hello. And I think just your capacity to laugh at that and think about that's important. It's real. It's coming. Might we live now so that we can have that great day together sometime, I pray. In the name of the Lord Jesus Christ, amen.